Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the alarming new study published in the journal Biological Conservation, which predicts large-scale extinction of insect species as a result of loss of habitat due to agricultural practices, urbanization, and deforestation. Francisco Sanchez-Bayo, an environmental scientist and ecologist at the University of Sydney, Australia, joins us to discuss his study, which he's the lead author of, that finds bees, ants, beetles, butterflies and dragonflies are disappearing 8 times faster than mammals, birds and reptiles. Furthermore, they provide food for birds and other small mammals, and they pollinate around 75% of the crops grown around the world, as well as replenishing soils. And while we face both a climate change crisis and a biodiversity crisis in which human activity is threatening the planet itself, as well as causing the loss of 83% of all wild mammals, the collapse of insects would create a bottom-up cascade, like removing the base of a pyramid. And although we can identify with majestic endangered animals like elephants and panthers, insects are small, creepy bugs people don't like. And that attitude has to change before we lose the bees and the butterflies and end up with cockroaches and flies inheriting what's left of the earth. Then, award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age, Douglas Rushkoff, joins us. Named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT, he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at the City University of New York, and the author of a new book just out, Team Human. We will discuss how our technologies, markets, and cultural institutions, once forces for human connection and expression, now isolate and repress us. And if we are to resist and survive, we must come together and recognize that being human is a team sport. Then finally, we'll get an update on the latest revelations inside the Mueller investigation exposed in court filings on Friday, which indicate a key meeting on August the 2nd, 2016, between Trump's top campaign official, Paul Manafort, and his deputy in Ukraine, a Russian military intelligence officer, Konstantin Kalimnik, goes to, quote, the heart of what the special counsel's office is investigating, according to Andrew Weissman, one of Mueller's top investigators. Anders Aslan, who knows both Manafort and Kalimnik and worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow and was an economic advisor to the governments of Ukraine and Russia, joins us to discuss the extent to which Manafort was a Russian asset doing the Kremlin's bidding. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Francisco Sanchez-Bayo, an environmental scientist and ecologist at the University of Sydney. He is the lead author of a new study published in the journal Biological Conservation, which predicts large-scale extinction of insect species as a result of loss of habitat due to agricultural practices, urbanization, and deforestation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Francisco Sanchez-Bayo.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you. And is it quite as alarming as the reports that have resulted from your study that indicate that the insects that we like, for example, butterflies, dragonflies, and bees, are on the path to extinctions, and the insects that we don't like cockroaches and houseflies, will inherit the earth?
Well, yes, it's basically that, although I didn't say the last part that you mentioned, that the cockroaches and the flies will inherit, but it's possible because they are the ones that are might be increasing, and some of them are increasing, we know, and therefore they will take over. Yeah, but by and large, your statement is correct, and that was precisely the conclusion of our study. As I should say that our study is a review of 73 studies done by specialists in the different groups of insects, entomologists, of course, over the last 30 years and published in different journals. So what we have done is to put together all these studies and try to analyze the numbers that each one has produced to give an overall picture of what's going on.
But the insects that are facing extinction are so important. They provide food for birds and other small mammals. They pollinate around 75% of the crops in the world. They replenish soil, and they keep pests in check. So I imagine the agriculture sectors have to be alarmed at this prospect, even if, as you say, that one of the problems is loss of habitat due to agricultural practices. So agriculture is both a cause of the problem, and they are going to suffer disproportionately, are they not?
Exactly, just as you say. Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah, we identify agriculture as the main driver of the declines. Of course, the others are combined to some extent. For example, pollution, when we talk about pollution as one driver, we identify fertilizers and pesticides, in particular insecticides, you know, which are designed to kill insects. Are the main drivers concurrently with the loss of habitat. Both things go together. Yeah, as you say, so it should be like that, but the problem is the agricultural systems at the moment are dominated by the big companies, the agribusiness companies, and they have changed the rules of the game. They have thrown away the IPM practices that we used to have for many, many years. And IPM stands for Integrated Pest Management. Mm-hmm. And that means that we put the natural systems first and the pesticides last. Pesticide is the last tool to use, which is only used when we need, when there is a pest outbreak in a particular place, but not all the time, not consistently. So that's what has changed, and that's precisely what we notice, that the highest decline, or the sharpest decline, has occurred in the last 30 years, which is when these practices have changed.
Well, apparently there are rapid declines of insects in Germany, and there have been an enormous drop in the numbers in the tropical forests in Puerto Rico. I don't know whether that's hurricane-related or related to global warming. What's the evidence there?
Yeah, okay, it's two different studies. They came to the same conclusions and almost to the same numbers. So when we put them together, together also with another study done in the UK a few years earlier, we came up with a figure of 2.5% insect decline in biomass per year. And that's really frightening. Now, in the case of the study done in Germany, which included 63 natural forests or regions that were protected, not just forests, wetlands and others, and analyzed the different factors that could be contributing to this decline in Germany, which was about 70 or 80%, they found that none of the factors had really a big impact. So there was 80% of the declines were unaccounted for. And then they also realized, well, one thing they forgot to take into account was the usage of pesticides, perhaps because they couldn't collect the data or whatever. So they thought that that was probably the main reason why all these insects were disappearing in these areas. And as I said before, the areas were very different in different locations. But that study was done over a period of 30 years, year after year. Now, the one in Puerto Rico is a bit different because they did only two samplings, one about 30 years ago, another one recently. And they compare the biomass of insects that happened to be 30 years ago and the one they have now. I think it's two places, kind of one or two different locations, which were tropical forests. And during that period, they realized that there were a few cyclones that were devastating in the region. And of course, that's probably the cause, the main cause of the disappearance of those insects. In that study, precisely the authors mentioned pesticides was not an issue, which is probably true. But I wonder if they took into account the new generation of insecticides that have been replacing the old ones. What happens is, in many countries, including here in Australia, for example, when you ask the authorities to give you the data about pesticide usage, they only give you the sprays, because that's what the consultants and the farmers have in the records. They don't count the systemic insecticides that are coating the seeds that they have been using in the crops. So those systemic insecticides go undetected. They are not accounted for. And they are the ones that have been replacing the old insecticides. So, of course, the old insecticides go down in numbers and in applications, but the new ones go up. So the authors of that study, they probably didn't take into account that. But anyway, so it is a reality that in the tropical regions, climate change is a big factor. Apart from the cyclones, it could be that the temperature increase has affected many species of insects because, as we know, insects in tropical regions are very intolerant of changes in temperature. It's what we call thermal intolerance. Whereas the ones that live in North America or in Europe or here in Australia are very tolerant. They are very adaptable to those changes in temperature.
And again, I'm speaking with Francisco Sanchez-Bayo, an environmental scientist and ecologist at the University of Sydney. He's the lead author of a new study published in the journal Biological Conservation, which predicts large-scale extinction of insect species as a result of loss of habitat due to agricultural practices, urbanization, and deforestation. And, of course, apparently there's not a, you mentioned the research done in Europe and North America, but very little has been done apparently in Africa and South America.
Yes.
But when people talk about a sixth mass extinction, of course, there have been five other mass extinctions in the last 4 billion years as a result of meteorites and ice ages and volcanic eruptions, etc. But the one that they're talking about now is one of, that's a result of human actions. And we Absolutely. Clearly already have a biodiversity crisis along with a climate change crisis. So since the dawn of civilization, apparently, humanity has caused the loss of 83% of all mammals. And in the last 50 years alone, the population of mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish has fallen by an average of 60%. So that is alarming enough. And now you're bringing in a new study telling us about the insects.
Yeah, exactly. It's not that it was neglected. It wasn't neglected by the expert, the entomologists that have been working on this for many, many years. For example, in Europe and North America, there are records, comprehensive records of insects in groups, like, for example, mayflies and caddisflies in the streams of Iowa and Illinois. Those records have been there for 130 years. So, and it's precisely because there's been that interest from very early on that now we have a historical perspective. So when we do surveys right now, we can compare what the entomologist predecessors found and what we find now, and then we can see the differences. We can see how many species we have lost. We can see that some species are new, they have been introduced, and we can calculate the rates of change. Okay, so yeah. Coming to your question, which is the problem is, so although we have been studying this, it's been kept only in a very small circle of the experts. Now, what we have tried to do is to bring this to the public by putting it in a comprehensive way, by showing this is happening. And it's alarming because the numbers we found are much higher, the ones that you just mentioned. So the rate of extinction in insects is 8 times higher than the one happening among vertebrates. And we don't realize that the insects are the base of the ecosystem for many animals, for many vertebrates that depend on them, birds, bats, all the reptiles, all the amphibians, many fish, particularly freshwater fish, all of them depend on insects as food. They are very important for the flowering plants. Flowering plants are the dominant plants on Earth, but the majority of them require pollination by insects. So without insects, there will be no flowering plants and there will be none of those animals I mentioned before. So it's like removing the base of a pyramid. The whole pyramid will collapse. And so, yes, we are observing, and other people have noticed, that we are doing this ourselves by the changes we have done into our environment in by many ways. But that is all linked. So the disappearance of many of these vertebrates, particularly birds and insectivorous animals, is linked to the collapse of the insects. So one depends on the other. And by showing this, we can raise awareness that we cannot just put money in protecting the pandas and the elephants. That's very good. But we had to be take a different approach. We had to take an overall approach that goes to the basis of the problem, to the drivers, which is agricultural intensification. We had to change our ways of doing agriculture. We had to go back to sustainable ways of doing agriculture. We can use pesticides, but you can use them only when they are needed. Okay? And in that way, we might restore the ecosystem. We might bring back those populations that are disappearing, and we may be able to sustain all the other animals that depend on them.
Well, indeed, we have to rethink the way we see insects as bugs and irritants. And of course, we love elephants and panthers and all the big mammals that are facing extinction. But we've got to learn to love the insect, right?
Yes, at least we have to allow them to live. Because, right. For example, my kids told me once, so, Dad, what is the importance of mosquitoes? Why do mosquitoes have to exist at all? Right. And I said, okay, they are a nuisance for us, it's true. But mosquitoes provide so much food to so many other animals, frogs. And so if you want to have frogs, you need to have mosquitoes. Right. So maybe sometimes we don't understand the role that many of the species fulfill in nature. Oh, for example, cockroaches is another example. People complain about cockroaches having them in their homes, and they ask the pest control companies to come and eradicate them. But cockroaches get rid of all the rubbish that we produce. So, right. And we don't know how to manage the waste problem that we have. At least we don't know how to do it here in Australia. I don't know in the United States. Right. And people complain about it. Well, let the cockroaches grow and then they will get rid of that, you know.
Right.
We have to see the insects in the whole picture, how they fit in nature. It's not just for our own benefit. Many of them don't have any benefit to us, but they have benefit to many other animals. And all things in nature are interlinked. So we cannot just say, okay, I don't want this species because I don't like it. It's a nuisance, you know, because we don't know the damage we are doing to others.
Well, just in closing, Francisco Sanchez-Bayo, how do people get this extremely important study that you and your colleagues have put together here? Because it's gotten a lot of international attention, but where can our listeners get it?
Oh, I think by doing what you are doing now, broadcasting this to the general public. Mm-hmm. I mean, I must tell you.
We'll put that on our website then to make sure that people get it. But, and obviously, along with starting to learn to love the insect, we also have to, I guess, change our eating habits, our farming habits, and we've got to deal with climate change. So there's,
absolutely.
There's quite a lot on our plate here.
It is.
But I thank you very much for your study, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, Francisco Sanchez-Bayo.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Francisco Sanchez-Bayo, an environmental scientist and ecologist at the University of Sydney in Australia. He is the lead author of a new study published in the journal Biological Conservation, which predicts large-scale extinction of insect species as a result of the loss of habitat due to agricultural practices, urbanization, and deforestation. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT and the author of the new book just out, Team Human. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age, the host of the popular Team Human podcast. He has written 20 books, including the bestsellers Present Shock and Program or Be Programmed. And he made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like and Merchants of Cool, and he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at the City University of New York in Queens, where he is a professor of media theory and digital economics. He's the author of the brand new book just out, Team Human. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Rushkoff.
Great to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And Team Human, of course, the front page of your new book reads, "Our technologies, markets, and cultural institutions, once forces for human connection and expression, now isolate and repress us. It's time to remake society together, not as individual players, but as the team we actually are, Team Human." So that's who we are, but we have fallen from grace, in a sense, and you're issuing a rallying cry to get us to come back together, because we're essentially social creatures and we achieve our greatest aspirations when we work together, not as individuals. So you're in a battle against rugged individualism, right?
I guess partly, or the mythology of you know, strident individualism. No, I do believe if I read my Darwin correctly, that evolution was not a battle of survival between individuals, but it's really the story of how species cooperate and collaborate to survive. You know, the story I was told in school about how the trees compete to reach the sunlight and the big tree shades out the little tree, it's just not true. It turns out the big tree is giving nutrients to the little tree through a network of mycelia in the soil, which also turns out to be a living thing and not dirt. And then in the winter, when the big tree sheds its leaves, the little evergreen tree gives nutrients back to the big tree. So the whole story that we've used to really kind of sustain or to prop up an understanding of capitalism or of the competitive marketplace, it's just not real. And it's part of why we've ended up living in ways that are so incompatible with, you know, with sustainability.
But why did the internet, which has so much promise as an extraordinary tool for education and information, how come it's become a conduit for trivia and for commercialism?
Well, in part because that original sort of dream or potential of the internet to connect people in new ways and allow all sorts of new things to happen, well, those weren't particularly profitable. You know, if anything, by around 1994, the media companies did a study and found out that the average internet-connected home was watching 9 hours less commercial television a week. So, you know, something really had to be done to stop that. And at the time, the internet was really just people talking to one another and going out on, you know, bulletin boards and discussion groups and sharing ideas and bringing their best selves to this place. The internet, if you remember, it used to be this place where people sounded smarter than they do in real life. They were afraid to meet each other after meeting online because they had presented such a beautiful kind of depiction of themselves as intellectuals. But so the internet story kind of moved off the culture page or the society pages onto the business page. And, you know, Wired magazine and other business publications came and said that the internet could save the dying NASDAQ stock exchange. And we used the internet to really pump, you know, steroids, I suppose digital steroids, you know, into the media space and into the marketplace. And we turned these tools into always on devices that are strapped to our bodies and trying to extract, you know, money and time and attention and data from us 24/7. You know, so it's sort of that, you know, combined with the fact that people who started internet companies really after the dot-com boom and bust of the late 90s, they were all expected to deliver massive returns to their investors. So a kid might go to Stanford or Harvard and come up with some interesting social idea on the internet. But once they take the $5 or $10 or $20 million from the venture capitalists, they're supposed to return 100 times the investment. And you don't do that by just connecting people in nice ways. You do that, you're going to have to try to find a way to extract value from all these people.
And again, I'm speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He is an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age, and he's the host of the popular Team Human podcast and has written 20 books, including the bestsellers Present Shock and Program or Be Programmed. And he made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like and Merchants of Cool, and he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at the City University of New York in Queens, where he is a professor of media theory and digital economics. So just let me quote a little from your book, Douglas. We are embedding some very old and very disparaging notions about human beings and their place in the natural order into our technological infrastructure. Engineers at our leading tech firms and universities tend to see human beings as the problem and technology as a solution. When they are not developing interfaces to control us, they are building intelligences to replace us. So you've written about the end of work. So to my mind, the end of work has both peril and promise. And if we are to be replaced, frankly, the idea of doing, manufacturing jobs or doing, turning the same screw a million times a day on an assembly line isn't exactly a great human achievement. So let's sort of tie that in, the idea of the fact that automation is starting to happen in the workplace and replacing human beings, but at the same time, this idea of a paying everybody basic wage seems to be a way to sort of have people vegetate, like in that movie Idiocracy, rather than, to borrow from Karl Marx, where from each according to his ability, to each according to his need.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly where to start. I usually go back to late medievalism, that right after we got back from the Crusades, or I guess Europeans did, and they had opened up all these trade routes, and they brought back innovations from the Moors. And one of them was the bazaar, what we call the marketplace. And people began to trade with each other and exchange value. They had local currencies. And, the middle class was formed from the former peasants of feudalism. But, the problem was that as the people got wealthy, the aristocracy got relatively poorer. So that's really when we got the industrial age. They invented the chartered monopoly, which meant no one was allowed to do business in a particular sector except, His Majesty's Royal Shoe Company. And the person who was the shoemaker now had to go to work. So we became employees when we used to be kind of small business people. And now, people are used to the idea of selling their time as workers rather than selling the value they create. But the tendency that this pushed forward was the idea of looking for the least qualified workers that you could find. You want them to be totally replaceable. So we invented all of these great, industrial age assembly lines and things just so that we could train people in 15 minutes. And people were at that point, people really are already acting like machines, when you're working on the assembly line or even working in the cubicle doing, calculations on mortgage rates. These are the reason these are processes that could be automated is because they were really invented to disconnect workers from the actual value and craft in what they were doing. So, now when I see politicians say, we want to get people jobs, we've got to get more jobs, I wonder who really wants a job. I don't think anybody really wants a job. People they want stuff, they want income, they would like to contribute meaningfully to the world around them, but jobs themselves are a relatively new construction and they're really here to support industrialism. So in that sense, the idea of having, robots or machines replace the work makes sense. The part that doesn't make sense is that we're creating jobs not because we need more stuff done, but we're creating jobs really just because we can't allow someone to participate in the spoils of the market or the spoils of capitalism unless they have a job to justify it. And so we get the government to give money to banks, to lend money to factory or to corporations to build factories, to give people jobs building crap that nobody even wants or needs, but we have to be convinced to want it, you know, through television commercials just to make more plastic doodads that end up in landfill anyway. So there's a, you know, there's a real backwardsness or a reverse engineered understanding of employment and value, you know. But by the same token, I understand why an Uber driver would resent basically driving around a car as a way of teaching algorithms how to do that job for him in 5 or 10 years. You know, and that's because these guys, the Uber drivers, don't own the companies that they're working for. They're just employees. So what I'm looking to promote, especially in a digital age, is really employee ownership of the companies they're working for, so that they, even if they're training their robot replacements, at least they will own the company that they've just invested all this time and energy into.
But it feels like it all comes down to a failure of imagination, in the sense that, for example, in Japan, people have to show up for work and spend endless hours, and the boss sits there twiddling his thumbs for endless hours, and they have to sit there and pretend to be working along with him. And then you have here in the U.S., particularly in Southern California, where people commute maybe an hour, 2 hours a day, or 4 hours quite often to and from work in gridlock, which is just pumping CO2 into the air and wasting a resource that we shouldn't even be burning because of global warming. And then they've got to go through all of that parking to sit down at a desk, when more and more people are discovering that they can do their work at home, they can spend more time with their family at home and do the same amount of work, if not more, at their own pace, obviously using the internet. And that has really, I think, shown the way. But what's your sense of whether or not we're prepared, or corporate America's prepared, to exercise more imagination? That seems to be, to me, an opening wedge for what you have been writing about in the past about the end of work.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. The interesting thing about I like calling it a lack of imagination, because, you know, what Wall Street and digital companies sold us as a revolution was really a very reactionary move. You know, what they made sure was that the internet, in spite of all its ability to distribute wealth and make things easier for people, you know, is that it would not be used for that. That the internet would not disrupt business as usual. So that, you know, the stock exchange is just fine. Capitalism is just fine. Thank you very much. And, you know, rather than seeing that, oh my gosh, we can move off this growth paradigm. We don't need to create corporations that grow for the sake of growth just to deliver capital gains to shareholders. We can start looking at, you know, models where everyone can share in revenue, and we can have sustainable businesses that can be right-sized, that can, you know, reach an appropriate size. We didn't. We just doubled down on what we were doing. And that, in many ways, is a lack of imagination. And, you know, sadly, it's the billionaire tech industry titans that I meet who seem the least capable of imagining new solutions, you know, or certainly new solutions to business. So they come up with a new operating system or a new platform of some kind, but they forget that it's sitting on top of another operating system, this, you know, this extractive, you know, stock market based investment scheme that they don't challenge, that they see that as a condition of nature. And that really is largely the problem, is that, you know, the landscape has changed, but they're using the same rules. And if anything, now they're, instead of those being, you know, laws, which we could see, they're embedding these values in code, which we can't, you know, in code which is proprietary and hidden from us. And then we assume that this is just the way these platforms have to be, as they get more and more power over us, as they become you know, bigger and bigger monopolies. But they really are imperiling us all for their lack of imagination. You know, they get to the point where a Bill Gates or a Mark Zuckerberg, because they've done business as usual, they get to the point where they say, oh, well, I'm going to give back 90% of my money or 99% of my stock and try to shove it back into the world, when the real problem is they extracted too much to begin with. You can't pull all the nutrients out of the topsoil and then just somehow shove them back in. In the same way, you can't just extract all the value from human communities and then think you can just buy your way back in there.
Well, the Wall Street model is to extract wealth, not to create wealth. But there's also, right. I think, the reality, and I wonder how widespread it's recognized in corporate America, that the extraction, consumption, and the pollution and the refuse that it caused, that cycle, is completely incompatible with the planet. And the planet is now showing enormous signs of stress, particularly with global warming. So how much is that recognition? I know they sit around hot tubs in Davos wringing their hands about the future of the world. And I thought that Dutch economist who gave them a wake-up call was really quite welcome, basically saying, you know, stop talking about inequality, start dealing with it, start paying your taxes, for God's sake.
I know. So taxes, instead of their philanthrocapitalism, which is usually some kind of a tax write-off or an investment in their own remediation companies. You know, the saddest thing about the billionaires I've met, and I was doing I ended up doing a TED talk about this, but I was invited to do a talk at what I thought was going to be a kind of a banker's conference, and it ended up being five billionaires in a room who wanted my advice on where to put their doomsday bunkers, you know, and how to maintain control of their security force after the event. So these guys are really busy trying to earn enough money to insulate themselves from the problems that they're creating by earning money in that way. You know, so they are painfully aware, maybe more even than we are, of climate change and the coming social unrest and the mass migrations of immigrants and refugees who are going to be flooded out of their cities and nations. But they're not looking at how to remediate it. They don't feel capable of fixing it. They really want to spend their energy escaping it. And if they're busy doing that, you know, how do we expect people, you know, regular people, to have a positive, you know, communitarian view of sustainability?
Well, there's so much to talk about, Douglas Rushkoff. I guess the simple answer is for people to get your book, Team Human.
Yeah, I mean, and even if they can't, I mean, Team Human is really just making a passionate and hopeful argument that human beings can reconnect in real ways and real places, forge solidarity, and address the problems of our time. I mean, it's less an activist book than almost a social book. I really do believe that you know, people being together, breathing together, you know, is the great conspiracy. That's what the word conspire, you know, quite literally means, is to breathe together. You know, and as we learn to do that, we increase our resilience as people. I'm kind of tired of trying to think up a new algorithm or a new operating system to combat all the bad ones, or looking at how to get Facebook to regulate itself. I'm a little bit more homeopathic at this point. I think that you know, people, we can strengthen our own immune system, our collective cultural immune system, and increase our vitality rather than just try to fight against those who are extracting it.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for what you do.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, named one of the world's 10 most influential intellectuals by MIT. He's an award-winning author, broadcaster, and documentarian who studies human autonomy in the digital age. And he's the host of the popular Team Human podcast and has written 20 books, including the bestsellers Present Shock and Program or Be Programmed. And he made the PBS Frontline documentaries Generation Like and Merchants of Cool. And he's a research fellow at the Institute for the Future and founder of the Laboratory for Digital Humanism at the City University of New York in Queens, where he is a professor of media theory and digital economics. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the latest revelations inside the Mueller investigation.
We are the robots.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. His books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It, and his latest book is Europe's Growth Challenge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslund.
Thank you very much.
And it seems that the court documents that were released from the Mueller investigation on Friday, the transcripts of discussions between Andrew Weissman, one of the lead investigators in the Mueller inquiry, and the judge in the case, at one point Weissman told the court that Paul Manafort's interactions with Konstantin Kilimnik, who you know both of these gentlemen, which included passing him polling information from inside the Trump campaign, quote, goes to the heart of what the special counsel's office is investigating. And the last time we spoke, I think it was in early December, Anders, you made the point that you thought that Manafort and Kilimnik were really at the heart of the matter, which is pretty much what Weissman is saying. So is the noose tightening here, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. And there were two things that came as a surprise to me here, not the close relations with Kilimnik and Manafort, but what they did, that they were working on a peace plan for Ukraine, which is a Kremlin project. So here we thought that it was entirely inspired from the Kremlin. We heard that there was a meeting in the Kremlin in mid-December. And then this peace plan, which was completely pro-Russian, came in by through four different channels to Washington in mid-January. I think that Lovochkin, the chief of staff of Yanukovych, was one of the channels. I think that the other channel was Artyomenko, that was publicized. I know that a former Ukrainian oligarch was a third channel. So they were pushing this by various means, and now it turns out that Manafort was not only distributing it, but even inspiring this peace plan. And the other element that was a big surprise, that is that Manafort, who's an outstanding pollster, provided polling data to Kilimnik, who we know works for Russian military intelligence, the GRU, and it was GRU that provided the hacking of DNC and did all kinds of things to interfere on social networks. So here they worked in both directions, both peace plan and providing the Russian intelligence with the insight where their interference in the U.S. elections would be most effective.
And this August the 2nd, 2016 meeting that took place with Paul Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik, along with Manafort's deputy Rick Gates, happened not far from Trump Tower. And of course, at that point, Paul Manafort was the campaign manager, so he ducked out into a dinner meeting at a private cigar room a few blocks away from Trump Tower to meet with Kilimnik. And this is where, apparently, I assume what's going on here, Anders, is that Rick Gates, who has been cooperating with Mueller, as opposed to Manafort, who cooperated but then didn't, and we don't quite know why, except the assumption is he's angling for a pardon from Trump. I take it that pretty much everything that was discussed there has been revealed by Rick Gates.
Yeah, and what it really looks like it is that Manafort has been closely cooperating with Russian military intelligence since 2005 when he hired Kilimnik. And he hired Kilimnik, who was known to be a GRU agent, presumably because Kilimnik was a GRU agent. So it was not a burden, but an intention that it looks like. And President Yanukovych hired a number of senior Russian generals for his administration, including the Minister of Defense and the head of the security services in Ukraine, which is the reason why the top of the military were completely penetrated by the Russians when the Russians attacked Ukraine in February 2014. So the picture of the Manafort, which was odious to begin with, becomes worse and worse. So what Manafort seems to have wanted to say to us before is that he was only corrupt. Now it turns out that he was probably a traitor also, and that he has been working directly with the Russian intelligence agencies.
So I'd heard at some point or other that there was a suggestion that maybe that was the Russians who somehow told Trump to hire Manafort. Does that ring a bell with you?
That version circulates among the Russian liberal opposition people. Mm-hmm. And it's quite possible. Manafort is a person of very considerable capacity. So when I heard indirectly from some of the Ukrainian oligarchs who had financed Manafort in Ukraine, that when they heard that Manafort had become Trump's campaign manager, they said, the election is over. Manafort is not in the business of losing elections. But it's even more interesting that Trump sacked Manafort so suddenly when it came out that Manafort has got $12.7 million in dirty money from Yanukovych. You would not expect that President Trump would consider that inappropriate in any way, but he sacked Manafort immediately. And here the Russian liberal opposition say this probably shows that Putin knew through his intelligence that FBI had so much on Manafort that it would be dangerous for Trump to keep Manafort. So the sacking of a Manafort is probably more interesting in this regard than the hiring of Manafort.
Well, we know that at least the Russians got a change in the platform at the Republican convention to make it more Russia-friendly. But what do you think went on in this meeting on August the 2nd, 2016, in terms of this peace plan? The contours of it seem to be that basically they divide Ukraine along the lines that the military situation has dictated, and that Yanukovych, the deposed president of Ukraine, who was essentially a Russian puppet who Manafort worked for, he would then become the president of this rump part of eastern Ukraine that would be an independent state. Is that a brief description of the plan?
Well, I think that the central thing was to get the West to stop the sanctions on eastern Donbass, eastern Ukraine, and the other central point to have the West in some way recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea. What happened to Yanukovych and what happened to this territory, I think, are of less importance. But I think that this was the central element. But it's also interesting that previously Manafort has presented this meeting as being about money, that they wanted to get money from Deripaska. What we now know is that Kilimnik had a meeting with Oleg Deripaska in Moscow for 5 hours. I mean, Deripaska is a serious person. He's not fooling around for 5 hours. So this means that they were seriously discussing how to manipulate the new U.S. leadership in order to get some kind of a peace deal through. And Deripaska has provided Manafort with $60 million in loans or whatnot, probably Deripaska has simply provided the Russian government services by paying Manafort for his intelligence service for the Russian government.
But what seems to be particularly incriminating is the is what's indicated here in these redacted court filings, that, that Manafort continued scheming with Kilimnik after Election Day. And during the transition, apparently Michael Flynn also was scheming in terms of this peace deal or this way to find a way to get Russia out from under or get Putin out from under the sanctions. So how do you see those tentacles? I mean, I assume that they will be revealed in the Mueller report, which, by the way, the former lawyer for Donald Trump apparently just remarked that he wasn't sure that the Mueller report would see the light of day.
Yeah, no, this is a legal matter here, but Mueller is appointed by the Department of Justice. He's a special counsel and not an independent counsel appointed by the Congress. So it's up to the Attorney General to decide if the report becomes public or about a part of it. But what we are seeing here is that Manafort wants to cover his intelligence work with Russia as much as possible. He's happy to be seen as corrupt, but he is not ready to give in anything on the intelligence part. And my suspicion is that he's simply afraid that he would be assassinated if he came out and had revealed this information. So he might simply be afraid for his own life, and then it's better to sit in prison where you're reasonably safe than to be out where you can easily be killed if you are a person like Manafort.
Well, if you steal from Russian oligarch with a ruthless background like Deripaska, that seems extraordinarily reckless. And it's interesting that the minute that Manafort got the job as Trump's campaign manager, Deripaska stopped demanding his money being, I think, 20 or 30 million went missing from investments that Manafort was supposed to make for Deripaska. And then after he got fired, then Deripaska then turns the screws back on again. So that's hardly coincidental.
Yeah, and there was one of Deripaska's executives who had been looking for Manafort here, who was sanctioned now by the U.S. Treasury, and he was revealed to be a DRU officer. Also, the British authorities revealed that Deripaska CEO in EN Plus, his holding company that was listed on the London Stock Exchange, was a DRU officer. So it appears increasingly that Deripaska has operated very closely with Russian military intelligence. And this is probably the reason why he provided Manafort with all this money. And if you don't really know if you are, will be allowed to keep the money, then a person like Manafort works all the more effectively.
So why do you think the U.S. Treasury Department under Steve Mnuchin gave an exemption to Deripaska? In other words, they lifted sanctions against his vast aluminum companies. What do you think was going on there?
I think that it was a mistake by the Treasury Department from the beginning. And clearly, the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, felt embarrassed because he had presented this nonsensical Kremlin list, which was just the Russian Forbes list of Russian billionaires, not implying that they had any particular close relationship with the Kremlin. Many of them live abroad for many years. So therefore, he needed to do something else, and he pushed for hard sanctions, and then they didn't investigate sufficiently. Rusal is 6% of global aluminum production, and what happened was that the aluminum price went up instantly by 30%, and the alumina price, the price of input for aluminum production, went up by 80%. So the U.S. Treasury destabilized the global aluminum market by sanctioning Rusal. So this should not have been done. Rusal is a decent, ordinary company, even if its owner is not so. And the heart of Rusal is the four giant aluminum smelters in East Siberia. In order to be able to manage these companies, you need to be tough. You need to be able to handle the organized crime in the area, to handle the lawless law enforcement authorities, and to handle the regional governors, and worst of all, the Kremlin. Deripaska has all these skills. He's a tough guy. But who could do it if not Deripaska? Only the Russian government. So when the U.S. Treasury told Deripaska, you have to sell down, I told these people, don't you understand that there can only be two alternative owners of Rusal, either Russian state or Deripaska. And they refused to understand it until they finally gave up and came to a fictitious solution where Deripaska sold down, but didn't really sell down, but kept a majority together with himself in a family foundation. So it was simply a poorly prepared job. But what the U.S. Treasury should have done in order not to make it look as a concession to Russia is that they should have carried out other sanctions of a corresponding effect in order to get it right. Now, instead, we have seen today that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has put out a very tough a sanction bill headed by Senator Robert Menendez.
Well, just in closing, I mentioned earlier about President Trump's former lawyer, John Dowd, saying that he didn't think the Mueller inquiry would see the light of day, that the public would never see it. Do you think he knows something about William Barr? Or what would prompt him to say that? I know we're speculating.
I think that it's legally possible, and they, of course, want that it will work in that direction. Mm-hmm. But I would be very surprised if it will be possible to keep it out of the light of day.
Well, Anders Aslund, I thank you very much for joining us, and I guess all we can say is that we're probably going to be speaking sooner than later, right? With an update.
Thank you very much, Ian. Always nice to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslund, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, a member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And his books include Russia's Capitalist Revolution, Why Market Reform Succeeded and Democracy Failed, and Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. And his latest book is Europe's Growth Challenge. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.